It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kitt.
And I'm Rob Verrett. The U.S. is launching a new program this summer that will create savings accounts for all newborns in the U.S. under the reconciliation bill passed last year.
Starting in July, the federal government will contribute $1,000 to each account to jumpstart the savings for all children born between the start of 2025 to the end of 2028.
Here in Wisconsin, state lawmakers introduced a bill that would match that initial federal government contribution with $1,000 of state funding.
A separate bipartisan effort in the state legislature aims to create college savings accounts for Wisconsin newborns that would start with $25 of state funding.
We're checking in now on what kind of impact these kinds of financial tools could have and what parents need to know as they think about saving for their children's long-term future. Tim Smeeting is a Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison and has written multiple books on economic mobility across generations. Tim, welcome back to the show.
You're welcome.
Now, these new accounts, they're being called Trump accounts. They went through different permutations before they were passed. The basics, how do you see them working for families? What do people need to know, especially if they have, you know, newborns in the right span of years?
It's $1,000 in seed money, and it can be matched by the government. In any given year, you can put in a maximum of $5,000. When a child turns 18, they can spend the money in one of four ways: higher education expenses, other qualifying post-secondary credentialing, in other words, getting some sort of an apprenticeship, small business or farm expenses, or purchasing a first home. When the child turns 31, they have access to the full funds of the account, and distributions are taxed at the capital gains rate. One thing they really do is they make you think about the future. In other words, right off the bat, people start thinking, oh, what can I use this for? Oh, maybe my son or daughter should go to college. So it focuses thoughts. But a concern, of course, is that low-income families are more likely to need to dip into the savings or investment accounts for emergency expenses. And they were going to pay higher rates than the Trump accounts if they're not used on qualifying expenses before the beneficiary turns 18. So if they withdraw money before, there's going to be a penalty and, you know, the costs are going to go up.
Now, you've been looking at poverty and economic inequality in the U.S. for a long time. If I said to you, Tim, hey, we got $1,000 for each newborn, what would be the best way to use that to benefit them, to help especially the kids in poverty? Would it look something like this, or would there be more productive directions that would be better ways to invest?
Well, I keep thinking that we need to redesign the child tax credit. Right now, the child tax credit pays $2,000 a year, but it only pays it to the top two-thirds of families with money. So in other words, the poor are excluded from it. If the child tax credit were there, then people could use this in order to build, you know, to do more for their children when they're young and get them ready. There's nothing wrong with putting some money in a 529 plan or some sort of a college fund and keeping it there, but kids need money more right away.
Now, the state of Wisconsin is looking at some kind of matching program for kids, something that goes along, enhances, adds to this federal program. Is that something that you've seen happen in other states even before this federal program was around? What do you think of the idea of states starting their own programs along these lines?
I mean, states, many do. California, Maine, Pennsylvania, Connecticut all give $100 when the child is born and put it into a college fund, a 529 fund, essentially. So that's there. In Wisconsin, one county out near LeClaire actually did it for a while, and the students at the Maxwell School studied it. I think, you know, the idea of just $100 or a small amount for college funds changes your focus. You start thinking, oh, maybe my child should go to college. You know, a lot of parents don't think about that until the child is in high school. And if they haven't taken the right courses or whatever, then it may be too late. So this is a way to help focus on the future for children, to think about what they're going to need money for, and to think about how you can afford to put them in college.
One thing I wonder about, Tim, as I understand it, these accounts we're talking about are not means tested, meaning, hey, your low income, it's $1,000, your middle income, $1,000, and so on. And one argument is, well, should it be more for people who need it more? On the other hand, people say, well, if you have to prove how much you make and how much you need it, that adds to the bureaucracy. This is a nice, simple way to do that. How do you weigh that balance?
Well, it's a tough way. Middle and upper income families, of course, they'll jump on this. They can put up the $5,000 a year into their accounts. And they can probably have a 529 as well. So you can have both accounts. And lower income families can't afford to contribute as much. That's one drawback. If it were done in a nationwide way and the funds were managed in Wisconsin, if we did this, the funds might be managed by our state investment board. But nationally, the money in these baby accounts would be managed by the Federal Reserve Bank and through the TSP and so forth. So it's hard. It's a hard trade-off. The most important thing is that, again, is that people focus on the future, number one. And that number two, they're thinking hard about college and they're given information that college is affordable. They're given information about programs like Bucky's Promise or like other programs. So they know that the tuition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for in-state students is only a little more than $11,000 a year. They know that we have a program now that if you're in the top 5% of your new program and the top 5% of your class in Wisconsin, then you're going to be able to get into a place like University of Wisconsin-Madison or another state institution. So all of this is sort of thinking for the future. Those who already think for the future, the well-to-do, they're going to take advantage of it. There's no doubt about it. There are limits, though. You can't put more than a certain amount into it. But for kids and for low-income kids, it's a way of thinking of the future. It's a way of getting started. Now, if you can, you can have a GoFundMe to help match money for this. But the thing about these Trump accounts and the future accounts are that you can also use it for home ownership. So if the child decides, okay, I'm not going to college, but I got a job, and gee, I wish I could afford a home, you can use it to purchase the first home. You can make a down payment with it. So it's all sort of focusing people on the future. All of these plans are to sort of think about the future, think of a longer term than tomorrow, think about the sorts of things you want for them that you might not be able to afford, and this allows you to afford more of them.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Tim Smeeding, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison, with us today to share his thoughts on state and federal efforts to create long-term saving accounts for newborn children. Now we're getting some practical advice on how parents can best help save money for their children's future. Emily Guy-Birkin is a personal finance expert based in Milwaukee. She's written 5 books on money management, including The 5 Years Before You Retire. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, as you are looking at personal finance for people, are you hearing a lot of people talk about, especially new parents, talk about these accounts for newborns?
So it's not really widespread quite yet. I think there is still this kind of intimidation when it comes to the idea of setting money aside for your kids. There's this kind of high barrier to entry when it comes to investing for your children. You know, listening to Tim talk about these new account options, one of the big benefits, I think it is that it lowers the barrier to entry to investing, especially for parents of newborns, because, you know, put one more thing on your plate, you know, you've got a baby who won't let you sleep, and it's like, okay, now figure out how to invest. Even if you feel confident that you've got money to set aside for your child for the future, like navigating the world of like, okay, you need to figure out how to open an investment account and then figure out asset allocation and then figure out how to contribute even initially or on a monthly basis or an annual basis. All of that sounds like way too much. So I'm not necessarily hearing much about this from new parents, in part because they're, you know, worried about keeping the baby alive and, you know, the price of formula and those sorts of like very immediate worries that parents have, rather than those kind of long-term worries and thinking about the future that Tim was talking about. And so that's one of the things that I think could be really beneficial about having this, like, everybody gets it sort of account, which is that it becomes a great equalizer in like, oh, there's instructions everywhere for how to set this up and make sure that every kid has an account and here's how the investment works. Instead of it being something that each parent has to take the initiative on, which is, I think, a big part of why it is on the, you know, mental to-do list until all of a sudden your kid's 15 and you're like, I never thought about how to set money aside for my kids so they'd have something when they're an adult.
And I was thinking about you, Emily, when this was coming out, because we've talked a lot over the years as much about the psychology, right, of saving mm-hmm. money for the future as the, like, practical aspects of it. And this idea that, okay, there's this built-in place. Maybe it's not the 100% best, most highest return for my kids, but it's a thing I can do without a lot of legwork that can overcome that initial obstacle, do you think, for a lot of parents?
Oh, absolutely. A plan that's, like, you know, 70% optimal that you will do is much better than a 100% optimal plan that you don't do. One of the things that I did prior to getting on this call was I looked up. So if, for instance, this was available when my eldest was born in August of 2010, if there was $1,000 that was put in just the S&P 500 in August 2010, it would be worth about $8,380 today if I didn't do anything else about it. If I put $10 a month in, then it would be worth about $13,400. And so those are things where, like, the S&P 500 is the kind of like the set it and forget it version of investing, where it's an index fund that is the 500 largest companies in the stock market. And it basically recreates what the market does. So when the market's up, the S&P 500 tends to be up. When the market's down, the S&P 500 tends to be down. And so that is something that if you decide to invest and you don't want to think about it, this is an easy index to invest in and feel reasonably confident that it will do as well as the market as a whole.
If you could speak, Emily, directly to that new parent, this new thing's available, they're going to find out about it. I think it's showing up on tax filing forms and things like that. What would you say to them now they've got that $1,000 going in about how to say, okay, I don't have a ton of spare money. Maybe I could put a little something into this per month. How should parents evaluate that decision of how to build on that now?
What I want parents to understand is that the benefit of doing this young is a tiny little bit of money every single month when your child is a baby grows so much over time compared to a 55-year-old trying to make sure they have enough money when they turn 65. Now, you might be trying to, for when they turn 18 and they are going to college, that's a little bit more comparable to a 55-year-old planning for retirement. Mm-hmm. However, there's still so much time available from newborn to age 18. That is the definition of long-term investing, because you're still planning for like a 15 to 20 year time horizon there. So what that means is if all you can afford is $5 a month as a consistent contribution, then set up an automatic contribution of $5 per month. If you can afford 10 or 25, then do $10 or $25 per month and make that the automatic contribution that you can do. And it may feel like it's not doing anything. But as I said, if I did a $10 contribution starting from August 2010 to now with a $1,000 initial investment, that would be worth $13,400 for my 15-year-old son now. That is fantastic. That would be, as Tim mentioned, that would pay for one full year plus a little bit of tuition for University of Wisconsin schools without feeling like I gave up anything, because that's $10 a month. I mean, you know, that's a coffee once a month.
Now, I know you're a big fan of getting parents to talk to their kids about money issues, and I want to use these accounts as maybe a lesson. Now, right now, they're newborns. I guess you could sing lullabies about compounding interest or something. But as the kids get older, what kind of conversations do you hope parents have with their kids about these accounts, what they could do with them, thinking about college or homes in the future, and, you know, to start thinking in that long-term view of financial well-being?
You know, I think that it would be really helpful to, like, be really open and honest with the kids about it. as they grow up, you know, have some time when the parents are taking care of their financial tasks. And, you know, your kids come in and ask, what are you doing? The same way when they ask when you're cooking or gardening, what are you doing? You know, invite them in. Make sure that while you're, you know, paying bills, click over to their child account and say, hey, let's look at your money too. And show them what that is, because kids, of course, love when things have their name on it and are about them. Like, I have money. Yes, you do. Look at this. This started when you were born, and this is how it's grown, like you're growing. And that can be a way to kind of start talking about finance and explaining things like compound interest and, like, you know, you grow by eating vegetables and exercising and getting good sleep, and your money is growing through compound interest. And if this is something that parents don't necessarily know something about, you can, like, learn together about what compound interest is. Another thing that I think could be a lot of fun is you can start talking about, well, what do you think you want to do with this money when you are all grown up? Do you want to use it to go to school? Do you think you want to use it to buy a house? And, like, start thinking about it and, like, use it to dream, because that's what money is. It's a tool. It's something that offers you the freedom to dream. And so making it that kind of conversation with your kids is just a delightful way to open up that relationship with your child, that relationship with money. And so it doesn't have to be a source of stress, which it so often is for so many of us.
And then finally, Emily, this starts with kids born in 2025. There's talk of private investors expanding that range one way or another. But say, hey, there's a parent, they've got a five-year-old now. They wish they had this kind of thing. They're daunted by the idea of going out and finding some kind of savings vehicle for their kids. Briefly, some encouragement and how to get started.
So I know it feels daunting, but it's not nearly as scary as you think it is. Oftentimes, people in my profession and financial media, we have a vested interest in making it sound scary because then you need us. But it's really not nearly as terrifying as it may sound. You know, there's a lot of acronyms, there's an alphabet soup. But if you are, you know, a functional adult, then you can invest. So what I would suggest you do is maybe pick up a book or two. Do some Googling and, you know, find some information from trusted sources online about where to start with investing. I might recommend some books by an author named Emily Guy Birkin. She's pretty good. you know, start with finding a place where you might be able to open an account that you could start with investing there. And choose investment accounts through big name places that you have heard of. That's one aspect of it. And just kind of dip a toe in the same way that you do with anything else that you do. And remember, you were a beginner at everything you do. And while investing sounds scary, when you cook, there is a non-zero chance that you could kill someone with your cooking. With investing, no one's gonna die.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Always good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
Emily Guy Birkin is a personal finance expert based in Milwaukee. She's written 5 books on money management, including The 5 Years Before You Retire. She was with us today to share advice on how parents can best save for their children's long-term future. Earlier, we heard from UW-Madison Professor Emeritus Tim Smeeting about new state and federal policy efforts to create long-term savings accounts for newborn children.